Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We actually did get started on the Whiskey Rebellion, as you can kind of tell. And it wasn't hard, or I should say it's not difficult, in going through how somebody who's reporting the history to be able to point out some of the things that need to be highlighted, why that word was used, or why, you know, what did this really mean in context, what was going on and so forth. Because most people, if you just kind of read, you know, what they're telling you, then this means that you are actually, you know, tied to that, you know, that paradigm. And I'm here to tell you that there is no paradigm in, you know, the narrative that's, you know, America created slavery. You know, these are all deductions that people with, I'll just call them political agendas, the bench, in trying to promote evil and the subversion of our Constitution, we've constantly been attacked left and right by Hamilton and many others who have attacked and attempted to subvert the Constitution for their noble cause, as they call it. But as Washington clearly pointed out, it is always these noble causes that are, you know, that ultimately destroy any good nation. And the nation that we have was not only good, it was so well devised and designed that it has been able to withstand all of the assaults. We've, you know, the government has moved well beyond the framework of the Constitution, but the Constitution still exists, and the government is a house of cards now. We can blow it down. We can knock it out. We can actually get the government back that we're supposed to have. It's kind of there. It's just that we've been convinced that all this other stuff is legitimate, and it's not. And that's why understanding the Constitution and the ratification debates as they defined each of those lines in the Constitution, it just becomes crystal clear that they can't do these things without the states telling them to do that. And if they're doing it, that means that it's unconstitutional, and that the only way we're going to fix this problem and save America, save our Constitution, save our republic, is getting the states to unite, as Madison called it, interposition, but to getting the states to unite in republic review. Republic review is not just interposition. Republic review is auditing and definitively defining everything that is unconstitutional being done by this government, and then interposing in the shutting down and interposing into full compliance the federal government within that framework of the Constitution. It's really... I have a hard time admitting, and I have a hard time, you know, believing that this isn't that simple. I talk to people all the time, and they still look at me with this, you know, like I'm just way over their head. And I don't know. I need your help. Help me state this more eloquently, more succinct, and more concise, so that they get it. But I seem to be trapped and unable to get. You know, you can't include. You have. I mean, since you can't. You can't. Exclude, you have to include this concept of doing a full audit. You have to identify everything that the federal government is doing that's unconstitutional and get rid of it. First off, because they're spending money, they're spending energy, and they're spending, you know, resources on things that they have no authority to do. They're taking up debt. That is all a facade. We've got to stop this. We have a responsibility. We have a moral obligation to get our government back into full compliance before we lose our liberties for good. Anyway, as you know, the show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and we have a comment line, 425-270-5416. And as you know, we'd like and need you to help grow the reach of this show, period. We need you to help us actually get out to, you know, others and help them understand that the Constitution possesses everything we need to forcing the federal government into compliance. We just have to behave a very specific way. And that way is actually been identified by Madison and Jefferson. This is why we're putting these things all together. This is why I have this, I'll call it a curriculum. And when we get to the resolutions, oh, that is like the meat of the meat of the meat. I mean, it is the bloody part where, you know, you can, if you're a meat connoisseur and if you really like rare meat, you know, some people, you know, as a matter of fact, just as a personal aside, when I was a young man, a friend of mine who was in high school, he was a journeyman butcher because he'd been working with his dad as a child in child labor, because back then child labor was okay, and he was doing butchering and so forth with his dad, and they would be going out, and we went out, I think this is my senior year in high school, and he was basically going to go out and butcher a cow in the field with his truck, and you know, had all the tools to do that. It was really amazing. And as he was bleeding the cow in midstream, he basically took a little pan of the blood coming out and kind of just put it under there and pulled out the blood, and he says, "Now wait for this." And then he kind of heated it up to where it coagulated like a gel. You know, it's basically blood pudding, kind of, without any seasoning or anything else. And he said, "Try that, because that was like a filet mignon without having to chew." And it was. It was just really good. And so anyway, I'm getting to that point where you've got the pure, you know, the essence of the Constitution, not necessarily blood or, you know, making this, you know, an animal ritualistic type of thing. I'm sorry if I'm creating that type of imagery. But the fact is that the resolutions are the essence of standing up to federal tyranny and holding government accountable in no other way and no more effective than with the states uniting. And we've got a whole bunch of documents that we'll go through with these resolutions that will prove exactly what and why Madison emphasized interposition and never used the word nullification to his efforts of 1798, period. Anywho, let us just move forward. I can dive into the porn cycle of, you know, news and the things that people are railing on, but let's just wait for some marketing. But what we want to do is get into where we left off at the Whiskey Rebellion. And so I basically just told you that the Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, was pushing for the federal government to take over the debt. He also suggested an excise tax on whiskey to prevent further financial difficulty. It's kind of where we left off. And I basically pointed to the fact that, see, Hamilton, if you read his Federalist Papers, he had already come up with in his mind that this was what he was going to do. And he knew with Washington becoming president and his relationship with Washington, you go back into the Revolutionary War, and you will find that the one person that Washington respected the most, and actually as a junior officer, he had so much respect for Hamilton. He was in awe. Hamilton was a very literate man. He read a lot. And so it doesn't mean he was a good moral man. It doesn't mean that he was well-educated. He was literate, and he read a lot. And so Hamilton was able to dazzle Washington with his literacy. Washington was not as well-read as Hamilton or Madison. Out of the two, there's no doubt in my mind, Madison was the most literate out of the two and probably the most literate man in America, other than possibly Thomas Jefferson, just due to the fact that Thomas Jefferson, for the rest of his life after his presidency, he spent reading and reading and reading. I mean, he had a whole library. He ended up donating his library to the Library of Congress after the end of the Revolutionary War Part II, which was the War of 1812. And so, I mean, he had an extensive library. But the reason Hamilton was pretty well versed as well is because every time Jefferson was in France and was buying books that were unavailable in America, I mean, he made those books available and in the Library of Congress, these original books. But Hamilton, or I should say Madison, was the recipient. Jefferson was shipping these books to him. And so as he was taking them down to Monticello, what did he do? He read them. I mean, he wanted to read these things himself, and he goes, wow, this is just awesome. That's one of the reasons why when people saw Madison come up to the lectern to really start talking and lecturing and debating something, he was known as the most formidable debater because he was the most prepared. He actually walked up with books in tow. You know, if they would have had hand carts back then, he would have had carted books, but he could only take what his feeble body could carry. And they still saw that that was far more than what anybody else was willing to carry. I mean, nobody else went up there. They just kind of off of memory cited, you know, Blackstone or you know, Montesquieu or what have you. And I'm here to tell you that Madison actually toted those books, opened them up, and read so that they wouldn't just take his words for it. They would be forced, like I do, forced you to hear and read the words of these founding documents. So, that being said, President George Washington, after hearing Hamilton's, you know, concept of the Assumption Act and creating a whiskey tax to help keep the states and the United States from, you know, not being able to pay its debt and to, you know, get out of debt, Washington actually opposed it, and we'll get into what he does as soon as we come back from the break. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so anyway, so Washington opposes this. And instead of actually combating, what Washington does is he tries to go out. And so here's the question. Did Washington go on this little emissary tour to prove that he was right, or did he actually go out to sell Hamilton's idea because he looked at Hamilton's idea as not necessarily being opposed to, but actually thought it was a good idea and thought he would sell it? The way that this history is actually, you know,
laying it out there, Washington opposed it. So in some formal document, there may have been an opposition, but we know as well as everybody, if you have studied Washington, most Washington's formal papers and positions were written by Madison for the first 4 years of his presidency. Very rarely did he ever take positions. I mean, when his the positions he really took formally were as general or as an officer in the military, using his military authority, that type of thing. Never did he take positions as a politician, if you understand what I'm telling you. He treaded lightly, and that's why Madison ended up writing most of his acceptances and thank yous and those types of things. There was a good chance that Madison may have helped write his proclamation for the first Thanksgiving. I don't have evidence of that, but I do have evidence that, you know, the Bill of Rights and some of the things were playing forward in the very beginning of the first year of Congress. Washington, you know, actually utilized Madison. So, in other words, Madison sent this, congratulatory message from Congress on him being president, and then he wrote his President Washington's response back to Congress. And in other words, Madison was basically the puppet master, if you want to call it that. But he was in all honesty, he was doing this as a noble friend of Washington. And unfortunately, Washington, because of, his literacy and everything else and the way he was raised, his paradigm, he ended up becoming alienated from so many of his friends because he personalized politics and the business of politics, and which is why, Jefferson, I think Jefferson and Madison revered him and still respected him, and they went to his funeral. But Washington kind of took a scorched earth attitude. If he felt you crossed him, he didn't want to have anything to do with you. But if you weren't one to cross him, and if you were a complete stranger, he was known to have strangers show up on Mount Vernon to pay their respects, even foreigners or what have you, and he would put them up for the night. If it was appropriate that they didn't have, bed and breakfast, it was just getting late in the day, and he said, well, I'll stay here for the night. And he had quarters for him, and then he shown him off, the next day. Thank you for visiting. Thank you for your congrats, whatever. I mean, he was a very down-to-earth guy. But he did personalize his stuff. But anyway, President Washington, again, opposed Hamilton's suggestion of the whiskey tax. And so in 1791, because the whiskey tax was actually suggested in 1789, or actually the Assumption Tax, or the Assumption Act in 1789 and 90, and that's where basically Hamilton kind of dropped the bomb that he wanted to do this whiskey tax in 1790. So in 1791, Washington gets on his horse, and he actually goes throughout Virginia and Pennsylvania to speak with the citizens about their views. He has kind of these town hall meetings. And he also meets with local government officials to talk about this idea of a national whiskey tax. And it was actually met with enthusiasm. And Washington, at least that's how it was claimed, it was met with enthusiasm. And Washington took this assurance back to Congress, which passed the bill. See, and the way they worded this, and I'll just read verbatim, local government officials met the idea of a whiskey tax with enthusiasm, and Washington took this assurance back to Congress, which passed the bill. So in other words, was Washington really opposing this and out there to prove that this was a bad idea? Or was Washington out there being the guy to sell that, because who's going to tell President Washington, General Washington, that this was a bad idea? I mean, the word sycophants comes to mind, right? I mean, yes men, sycophants. Anyway, so I'm not convinced, because I have not seen any source documents that prove Washington opposed this. I honestly see, because of his actions and what he was doing, he was trying to do that political thing, that liaison to say, we're going to do this and we would need your support, because he respected Hamilton And it wasn't, you know, in many ways, Washington did make the ultimate decisions, but many ways he just jumped on board with an idea that seemed to be a good idea. And so, anywho, and this is one of the reasons why his first presidency was filled with stress to levels because of Hamilton and Jefferson. Hamilton was, if you read what Hamilton did as a Secretary of Treasury while Jefferson was still out of country and establishing the Department of State and the role and responsibility for the Secretary of State, I mean, Jefferson had every right to protest because the Secretary of State should have been a superior position than to what Hamilton made it. But anywho, so the bill passed, right? But protests against the new tax began immediately. So to Washington's chagrin, was Washington surprised? Arguing that the tax was unfair to small producers. Well, clearly, Washington had to have known this. And this is what we read in the previous episode, that this tax gave an advantage to those who had more affluence and producing more and so forth. And it was, in essence, this tax was un-American. It was progressive. It wasn't a tax that had some proportion of uniformity and equality amongst the producers. And it pitted large producers, or I should say small producers, against the large producers. The law was immediately a failure, since refusals to pay the tax were as common as intimidation against officials hired to collect them. Excise officers sent to collect the tax were met with defiance and threats of violence and unpaid bills. Violence first broke out. Now, to those who are at awe with historical dates, violence first broke out on September 11th, 1791. Excise officer Robert Johnson was riding through his collection route in western Pennsylvania when he was surrounded by 11 men dressed as women. See, they had sexual dystopia or this morphine and this perversion. I'm just kidding. The fact is that these men were trying to be disguised and trying so that, you know, he couldn't recognize who these men were. And so this mob of 11 men stripped him naked and then tarred and feathered him before stealing his horse and abandoning him in the forest. I mean, this is what they did. So these men committed a crime. And Mr. Johnson, understanding that and recognized two of the men in the mob, he made a complaint and warrants were issued for their arrest. A cattle drover named John Connor was sent with the warrants and he suffered. So it wasn't a sheriff. It wasn't, you know, the law of the land. It was a guy that was hired to go issue this warrant. And he suffered the same fate as Johnson. He was tied to a tree, tarred and feathered, and was in the woods for 5 hours before he was found. In response, Johnson resigned his post after seeing that what happened to him just happened to this other guy. And he says, you know what? I'm not looking for any more tar and feather. Have you ever been tarred and feathered? Go understand what tar and feathering is. And it is it actually violates the Constitution's Bill of Rights in what we would call unnecessary and or actually, you know what, you know, I'm going to have to pull it up. So I believe it is the eighth. I'm pretty sure it is the eighth amendment to the Constitution. And that is the excessive bail. Yep. And cruel punishment. And so we have a right that government or and the people shouldn't do this either, that we should not be subject to excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Well, you know, here's an ad just adds insult to injury, how these people actually issued a cruel and unusual punishment to these men for doing their job. things were escalating. Things were getting worse. And so I'm just letting you know the irony of it all beginning on September 11th. Do you think there's some historians out there playing and manipulating with us? Anyway, incidents escalated over the next few years. In 1793, the home of Pennsylvania excise officer Benjamin Wells was broken into twice. The first time, a mob of people forced their way in and assaulted Wells' wife and children. And back in those days, it wasn't as big and or as significant, I guess, if you assaulted. Now, when they say assaulted, that doesn't mean battery. I just want you to understand that the legal term and definition of those words, assaulted, means that they were, you know, verbally and or threatened. That is assault. Battery or beaten is a completely different word. And so just when they, you know, just to make sure when you're hearing this word assaulted, don't think that they were actually laying hands upon the wife and the child.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so even though there are some associations, I want you to understand that those who wrote history, if his wife would have been raped, if his wife would have been physically accosted and injured, that would have been noted because it would have been used as evidence in, you know, the trial and evidence in a crime. And so they, back in those days, they didn't necessarily, you know, get into those types of details other than to use the word assaulted or threatened. But today I know that there's a blending of assault. And so people, but I've learned from my father being in law enforcement and understanding law, assault does not necessarily mean that one has laid hands on you. Assault also means that you have been threatened and believe injury or bodily harm imminent. Okay, so battery is when you have been beaten. Assault and battery. So battery is when the fists have landed, if you understand what I'm saying. Anyway, not to belabor the point, but these are little nuances. I just absolutely believe that when you read these things,
if you understand how the History Channel and history education, those types of things, if they would have had evidence that, you know, there was rape or something like that, they would have been, because if it bleeds, it leads, right? They would have included that. So they wanted to use what they would consider the strongest word in describing how they want this narrative for you to read. These, what they're presenting is facts. Anyway, the second incident involved six men in disguises who attacked Wells while he was at home. The intruders demanded Wells' accounts books, or in other words, his accounting books, at gunpoint and insisted he resign his position. So they said they attacked him. Well, they forced his way into his home, and at gunpoint, they basically demanded that he turn over his accounting books, you know, of, you know, who's produced what and all of that, so that Wells would have to redo all of that work all over again, and insisted that he resign his position as the tax collector for the federal government. Feeling unrepresented in Congress, the citizens of West Pennsylvania gathered their own assembly with 3 to 5 representatives per county, while radical members pushed for open rebellion. Moderates like Hugh Henry Breckinridge and the future Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, Albert Gallatin, urged conciliatory measures. Now, I don't want to gloss over this, but this is very important. Feeling unrepresented in Congress, kind of like how the Englishmen in the colonies felt when they were being taxed and so forth. What does this mean? When you understand representation and how representation was apportioned to the state didn't necessarily create a direct tie of your representative. So what this is reporting is that there were people that the state never qualified as their representatives in Congress because they don't feel that they were being represented. However, that doesn't mean that the state formally had congressional boundaries, but that doesn't mean that those Congress people were And here back then, it was 30,000 people to a representative, my friends. How do you feel represented today when it's almost 1 million people to one representative, when the Constitution dictates that it's supposed to be 30? There's no amendment to the Constitution that allows more than 30. This is why this is such a problem. This is why I talk about we got to get government, we got to blow up government to basically shrink it, if you know what I mean. Because the oligarchy in the swamp, they're controlling us, and they're under the full control of the globalists. It's that simple. Anyway, radical members pushed for open rebellion, while, like I said, these moderates, like the future Secretary of Treasury, you know, wanted conciliatory measures. Well, in the summer of 1794, Federal Marshal David Lennox began the process of serving writs to 60 distillers in western Pennsylvania who had not paid the tax. On July 14th, Lennox accepted the services of tax collector and wealthy landowner John Neville as guide through Allegheny County. Now, this is where things kind of get kicked up a notch, and this is where some even more formidable attacks occur. On July 15th, they approached the home of William Miller, who refused to accept his summons. An argument ensued, and when Lennox and Neville rode off, they were face-to-face with an angry mob armed with pitchforks and muskets. Someone had told the mob that the federal agents were dragging people away, but Lennox and Neville were allowed to pass once that was understood to be untrue. Nonetheless, a shot was fired as the two men rode away. On the morning of the 16th, Neville was asleep in his home. This is how they kind of go through the accounting of the days and the chronology. It all tells a good story, right? On the morning of the 16th, Neville was asleep in his home, Bower Hill, when he was awakened by a crowd of angry men. So Bower Hill is his home or estate, Mr. Neville. John Neville, by the way. some of whom had been served summonses the previous day. So in other words, these men knew where you lived, and they're not going to take this, you know, intimidation of government lightly. And so they basically awakened him, you know, the next day, and the men claimed that Lennox needed to come with him, with them, because there was a threat to his life. Neville didn't believe the men and ordered them off his property. When the mob refused to move, Neville grabbed a gun and shot at the crowd, striking and killing Oliver Miller. In retaliation, the mob shot back at the house. Now, so just so you understand, the actual abhorrent violence occurred by those of government or representing government, the tax collectors. And so, to be clear, the actual first strike of violence was done by the mobs of this political unrest and so forth. So this goes down to, you know, was this the shot across the bow, or was this the shot heard around the world, whatever. Neville made it inside the house and sounded a signal horn, after which he heard the sound of his slaves attacking the crowd with firearms. So here's an interesting point, that in 1794, in Pennsylvania, in western Pennsylvania, there were still agrarians that had slaves, and that there was such a relationship between Neville and his slaves that they were trusted with firearms and defended the home against these attackers. Just an interesting added paradigm to what they're portraying here at the story. Because we knew that most of the northern states had abolished slavery. But, you know, this part of Pennsylvania, and many parts of Pennsylvania had abolished slavery as well. But obviously here's a part of Pennsylvania that didn't really, or Pennsylvania itself officially as a state did not abolish it. It had not gotten to the point where they said, you know, if you have any slaves, as you know, any persons as property, you must release them. That didn't happen. But the paradigm of abolition had happened. But it's an interesting note that here we actually have an incident where once slaves were trusted with guns and they defended the home, there was that kind of relationship between, you know, Neville, because there were many that you can read about, like Madison, and I forget this other gentleman, that actually, you know, protected. I mean, it was a bastion, and it was a world of what you would call slavery, but it was actually compassion and support and service, because here's a man that inherited generational slaves because of his generations, and, you know, abhorred the practice, wanted to free them, but he knew he couldn't, because if they were freed, then they would be captured and the false documents would be created to steal these men and to put and subject them to the harsh punishments of slavery. And so I forget this one gentleman that did this, but he clearly, in his last will and testament, before he died, as the doctor that was there to witness his death, also witnessed his will of testament, you know, in front of the slaves themselves that were being set free, so that the doctor would attest to, because I believe that this doctor was a kin in heart of abolition. And so these types of stories absolutely existed, where these men, you know, that died says they are not to be sold with the estate. They are to be given their freedom and to get them the heck out of here, because they knew if they were allowed to languish on the property or do anything, you know, in the state or the local vicinage, that they would have been subjected to being enslaved again. So it kind of tied the doctor's hands to be his agent in getting those slaves as, you know, as far away and as safe as possible. Those types of stories are not aberrations, my friends. Those stories are being suppressed so that we understand, because the narrative that is of the day that they're trying to sell, that they want you to believe, is that, you know, America was the, you know, the creator of slavery and the evil institution that America is. And that those are all lies. That's all deceit. So anyway, as six members of the mob were wounded before they fled Miller's body, before they fled with Miller's body, who was dead. So we're going to be back, and I'm going to finish this little story of the attack and the destruction of Bower Hill, because they come back and they destroy it. We'll get into that, because this is all just kind of ramping up and escalating and escalating, and everything that's being witnessed in Washington, D.C. is being reported and escalated as well. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we kind of just wrapped up the attack on Mr. Neville's home, well, and the killing in defending his home, so now they've left, but they're not done. On July 17th, the next day, as many as 700 men marched to the drums and gathered at Neville's home. They demanded his surrender, but Major James Kirkpatrick, one of 10 soldiers who had come to the property, so in other words, 700 against 10, these 10 that came to the property to help defend it, answered the 700 men that Neville was not there. And in fact, he had helped actually Neville escape into a hiding in a ravine. He helped him escape the house and sent him to where he knew he would be in this ravine area by a river. Anyway, the mob demanded that the soldiers surrender. When that request was refused, they set fire to a barn and slave dwellings. The Neville women were allowed to flee for safety, after which the mob opened fire on the house. Following an hour of gunfighting, the mob's leader, James McFarland, was killed. In a rage, the mob set fire to other buildings, and the soldiers soon surrendered as the Bower Hill estate burned to the ground. Now we have actually more people dying in this escalation of a couple of days. So how long did this take to get to Washington? It took a little while. Getting to this part of western Pennsylvania was not an hour ride. Even the fastest horse could probably not do it in nothing short of a couple of days. And so when we look at, how things responded and how things kind of built up, that was the rule of the day. That was how things are. Today, we don't have this, folks. They can find out. They can move swiftly. News travels quickly.
representation, people move that. I mean, you can be around the world in a day. You can be on a plane and in another country on a very fast jet in a very short amount of time. As a matter of fact, they're actually looking at re-resurrecting the supersonic transport aircraft that had, for the most part, because of its age and the lack of innovation. Why? Because there was no necessity for people to travel that quick. People were willing to actually spend less money on the slow plane, you know, instead of, you know, spending a whole day, you know, or I should say a couple of hours, because how long did it take to fly from Europe to the East Coast on an SST? It was an hour or something like that, where it took, you know, several hours more in a conventional aircraft. Well, people say, well, that's okay. I'll take the several hours more. Plus, you know, supersonic transport causes these things called sonic booms and so forth, and people get upset when they boom at the middle of the night or throughout the day when supersonic transports are traveling over, you know, their head and so forth. So where, how, you know, how do they travel, you know, where they don't cause those interruptions? So those little types of things kind of made it hard. But I'm just telling you, today things are a lot different. And so back in those days, they you know, had to assess, they had to get the facts. That took time, and the response took time. You didn't go to war in a minute like we can do today. You don't launch a missile strike in a second like we can do today. Anyway, less than a week later, the mob met with local dignitaries who warned that Washington, President Washington, would send a militia to strike them down, and they had to strike first. They were assuming that that's what Washington was going to do. Wealthy landowner David Bradford, along with several of the men, attacked a mail carrier and discovered three letters from Pittsburgh expressing disapproval of the attack on. So they actually stole the letters. You know, this is what Benjamin Franklin did while he was the postmaster for the United States in London. He was intercepting mail, reading them, and, you know, understanding who these people were that only Benjamin Franklin, because of his ties and his dignitary status and so forth, that's why he was there. People going, you know, here is the genius of America. You know, the cream of America, and he's relegated to managing the postal services from England to America. People didn't realize that he was gathering the intelligence and reporting on this back to the Continental Congress and so forth. Anyway, so Bradford used these letters as an excuse to encourage an attack on Pittsburgh, inciting 7,000 men to show up at Braddock's Field east of the city. And so Braddock, I don't know who Braddock's Field is or if that person's important because it's not related here. But here's the story. Here's 7,000 men that have formed the city of Pittsburgh, fearing violence now. This is the key thing you need to understand. They understood that these 7,000 men were just going to come in and do bad things. Fearing violence, sent a delegation to announce that the three letter writers had been expelled from the city and to offer a gift of several barrels of whiskey. This was brilliant. As the day ended, the crowd had drunken so much of the whiskey that they weren't inspired to descend upon the city. In other words, with any fury or anything else, they had gotten drunk and celebrated, and they kind of forgot, or they got, you know, crashed and tired, because that's what happens when you get drunk. So they were taken out of their game. So instead of gaining permission to march peacefully through, they basically just went through, actually, instead of marching and burning and pillaging, and they just, you know, and or even gaining permission to go through Pittsburgh, they kind of just went off and did nothing. Washington then, though, and all of this had happened, Washington does actually, as he was stating, as David Bradford was stating, that, hey, they're going to send a militia, and we need to be responding first. So they did respond. They got drunk for showing up, and Washington actually federalized. But this didn't happen in a day. this took time for them to actually federalize the militia because, and I'm going to get into something that you need to understand as well, just in a second here, of how they were able to do this somewhat expeditiously. But bottom line, with the signs of the rebels and hoping to reignite the conflict and believing it was linked to unrest in other parts of the country, Hamilton wanted to send troops to Pennsylvania, but Washington opted for a peace envoy instead. The peace envoy failed. Washington met with his cabinet officials and presented evidence of the violence to the Supreme Court James Wilson, who ruled a military response was justified under the auspices of the Militia Acts of 1792. Washington assumed military and or emergency powers to assemble more than 12,000 men from the surrounding states and eastern Pennsylvania as a federal militia. Those states were New Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, and western Pennsylvania. Now, I think it was New Jersey that really didn't provide much. But the bulk of the men probably came from Virginia, maybe even Maryland, and western Pennsylvania. But I don't believe New Jersey provided much. But so here's the thing. We know in the Constitution that Congress has the power, and through the ratification debates, it had to be Congress, not the president, to federalize the militia. That's why the importance of Congress and a representative government, that they couldn't abdicate that responsibility. But now we're reading, and now we're learning, and now you can see how even in those days, Congress, started abdicating the responsibility. So this is why going through this Militia Act of 1792 is important as an aside. In Section 8 of the Constitution, the power to, quote, call forth, close quote, the militia was expressly given to Congress. But only 2 years into George Washington's presidency, the Second Congress temporarily delegated its authority under the First Militia Clause by passing a statute, a temporary law, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. The Militia Act of 1792 was meant to be a 3-year-long experiment, but gave the president broad powers to call out the militia instead of Congress. Section 1 of the act covered foreign invasions and imminent dangers from a foreign nation. Now, I want you to understand, when we're talking about this invasion on the southern border, is this an act of foreign invasion of imminent dangers of a foreign nation? Absolutely. What we're dealing with requires the militia or National Guard to be deployed to our borders. We need to call out the National Guard as unconstitutional. I know that insults a lot of great patriots that are serving in that, but I'm sorry. If you understand the Constitution, if they're going to change the makeup and the literally the essence of the militia into a National Guard, the way they've done it, from a county-organized militia into a state-only organized and basically marginalizing the counties, you need to actually amend the Constitution, as far as I'm concerned. What they have done in creating and ignoring the militia is basically tantamount is a violation and a bad violation. So we've just started going through this act of 1792, the Militia Act. We're going to go through this when we get back so we can finish up this Whiskey Rebellion in context to what the heck's going on today, because we need this kind of content. We need this information to place context to our real problems. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue.
Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.